first is number 20-2205, In Re Elster. Mr. Taylor.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, Jonathan Taylor for the appellant, Steve Elster. In this case, the U.S. Patent and Trade Office refused to register a trademark criticizing a former president. It did so for a single reason, because the mark identifies the person it criticizes by name, and Section 2C of the Lanham Act categorically forbids registering any mark that contains a name identifying a particular living individual without first obtaining their permission. That statutory prohibition, as applied to the speech in this case, violates the First Amendment. The government attempts to justify its regulation of speech as necessary to protect privacy and publicity rights and to prevent consumer deception and confusion. But the fundamental problem for the government is that Section 2C is an extraordinarily poor fit to achieve those objectives. As to privacy, the PTO interprets the statute to cover only celebrities and world-famous political figures, and the statute bestows special protection on the president alone.
Can you just clarify, where does the PTO limit this to famous people? So as opposed to any Joe Schmo who proves that this particular reference of a name would be understood as identifying him.
So the PTO in its manual specifies...
Is that binding?
No, but I think
like
that's the way
the
PTO...
patent side manuals are not binding, right?
That's right. But
is that the same in the TT, the trade?
I believe that's right, but we're looking to the way in which the PTO has enforced the statute in the real world. And I think what the PTO is trying to do is give some force to the statutory language of identifying a particular living individual. And if it's Joe Schmo, or if it's, you know, Joe Smith in the public, it doesn't bring to mind any particular person in the public's mind, that's not going to qualify. I think we can all agree that former President Trump is a particular individual under the statute, and therefore the statutory prohibition applies. And so I don't think there's a narrowing way to construe the statute here. I think the court just has to decide whether, as applied to the particular mark in this case, it violates the First Amendment.
And I assume you sensibly enough, I think, want to essentially view 2C for evaluation purposes by kind of subtracting out what's already covered in 2A, because 2C must perform some additional function, so you want to focus on the increment function, and that's either privacy or publicity, and privacy seems minimal because almost nobody with a real privacy interest is going to meet the condition. So it really comes down to this right to publicity?
I think that's right, and that's the way I understand the government's briefs as well. And I guess the way I would think about it is we're looking at the practical effect of the statute. And so if the government says, look, we're concerned primarily about preventing consumer deception or confusion, those concerns are already separately addressed by the more narrow prohibition that exists in 2A.
Well, that's not quite true. I mean, there are situations not covered by 2A where there's a legitimate interest in protecting the right of publicity. You know, for example, advertisement for a sandwich that says Tom Brady doesn't eat our sandwiches, but you should.
Right. I think that's right. I guess the way I would think about it is there are three categories of legitimate government interests, I think, when you're talking about the right of publicity. One is the false endorsement. You know, Tom Brady loves our product. If that's not true, then that's false commercial speech, and that can be properly prescribed. The second would be any mark that gives rise to consumer deception or confusion as to the source of the product. So if you're suggesting that the source is somebody else, that too can be properly prescribed. But what you're identifying, Judge Dyke, is the third category, which I think could be, in some context, a legitimate government interest, which is, you know, there's no real First Amendment value behind the speech. You're merely trying to exploit the celebrity of somebody else to attract consumer attention and make a buck. And I think you could imagine potentially a more narrowly drafted statute that just tries to get at that. And I think the problem for the government is this statute is just dramatically overbroad to achieve that objective, even if it were a legitimate objective. And I think it's...
So are you challenging the statute on its face or just as applied?
We're just challenging it as applied.
And I'm not sure that's right under Brunetti. Justice Kagan's opinion there, she seems to suggest that the statute has to fall and has to be redrafted by Congress rather than essentially redrafted by the judiciary.
I think that that's right, although I could imagine an argument that when you're dealing with a law that is motivated by viewpoint discrimination, it's this kind of root and branch illegitimate. And you have to invalidate the statute on its face. And if the government wants to come back, as in the case of Brunetti, and just target vulgar words or obscenity, it has the burden of coming up with a more narrowly tailored statute to achieve that objective. And so I could imagine, you know, making, you know, an argument the government might have on the other side, which is, you know, this statute, it could be constitutionally applied to certain speech. I think we're far beyond that, Judge Dyke, as you recognize in your separate opinion in TAM, when you're talking about a mark that expresses a core political opinion, that cannot be properly prescribed by the federal government consistent with the First Amendment, because even though it's used in the commercial sphere, it's still entitled to some protection and the governmental interest in...
Just so I understand, under your theory, what would be a proper application of 2C?
Well, I think it could be properly applied if there's a false endorsement. We don't have that here. I think it could be properly applied if this...
Wouldn't that be 2A?
Well, that it would just be redundant of 2A in that respect. If you're asking what additional work 2C could do that 2A might not do that could
That's
be constitutionally permissible,
right.
I think it might be the Tom Brady example. If you're just saying, you know, Tom Brady hasn't tried our product, but you should, it's really hard to understand the expressive value that the mark holder would have in invoking the name of the celebrity beyond just merely trying to capture the consumer's attention. And so, and you see this come up a little
and
bit.
Under, I guess I'm just trying to understand, under your theory, why wouldn't we strike down 2C as just overly broad?
I think you could. We're not asking for that remedy. I think it could be as a practical matter if the statute fails Central Hudson and it's just dramatically overbroad to achieve the objectives, even if you assume they're legitimate governmental objectives. And I think it falls to the government at that point if Congress wants to ensure that you don't have this gap and it really wants to prohibit the federal registration of marks that could, in some contexts, give rise to viable right of publicity claims, then I think Congress would have to go back to the drawing board and draft a more narrowly tailored statute. And that's not, you know, that you see that all of the time. I do think this particular statute is just dramatically overbroad given the objectives. And so,
can I ask you this? So, in both TAM and Brunetti, there was an sort of on the face of the statute a reflection of a government, I'm just going to call it impermissible motive, by saying we want to shrink in the world the amount of speech that we disfavor. Whatever else is going on here, it's so hard to see this as that, and you haven't argued.
We're not making
it. So you're really talking about the adverse effects on valuable speech and the lack of a justification for imposing those effects. And so that leads me to this question. When, suppose Mr. Elster gets this registration, and suppose it's not just for this particular three-word combination, but a variety of negative about Trump expressions. Doesn't that limit other people's ability to use those very valuable First Amendment expressions on their own, on T-shirts they might want to make?
I think so. So a couple of responses to that. The first response is, I would just note as a predicate that the registration of a trademark doesn't give rise to any distinct trademark rights. It's the use of the trademark. So,
right, but the whole reason we're here is that registration gives something of value.
Right.
So,
right, and so
And what it gives, I'm sorry, is something of value against other speakers.
That's right. That's right. But 2 points then on that. One is that I think that might be an argument for why Central Hudson could be the right kind of framework, because it takes account of the potential speech interests on the other side. But I would also note that if what someone would want to do with their speech is infringe my client's trademark and use the same mark as a source identifier of its own in a way that could give rise to confusion or deception, they wouldn't have a First Amendment right to do that. And so I actually think the First Amendment interests here are pretty one-sided. But I think that Central Hudson at least allows you to take account of that potential speech suppression.
I'm sorry, why would they not have a First Amendment interest in that?
Well,
if your client does?
If they want to use the exact same mark as their product or source identifier, then that could give rise to concerns about consumer confusion or deception, because the consumer might not know who's the source of the particular product if it's the exact same mark in the same market.
I'm having trouble finding it, because I have the same concerns that Judge Toronto has. It seems to me that if you allow the registration of essentially political slogans, positive or critical, that you are interfering with the First Amendment rights of other people to use those slogans, for example, to put out T-shirts or whatever. How does the patent office or patent and trademark office deal with that kind of situation? It does seem to me that allowing that kind of registration could interfere with the First Amendment rights of other persons who want to produce T-shirts using those slogans.
That's right, and that's, you know, but I think you could say the same about any mark that gets registered. And the patent...
Well, no,
trademark
no, it's not about any mark. It's about those that involve core political speech and, you know, speech in the public sphere. If your client is allowed to get a trademark on Trump Too Small on T-shirts, he's preventing other people from doing that too. Now, the answer to that may be that that's not an issue in this case. It's not something that's remedied by 2C, but it is a concern, isn't it?
And I suppose you could have made the same argument in the TAM case, where, you know, that's
why I started my question by saying Brunetti and TAM are about something suspect about the government motivation, and therefore is not just about effects on the real world speech market. Your case, I think, is really about just the effects on the real world speech market, which would seem to suggest some inquiry, at least in maybe not this case, but in the abstract, into the balance of those effects.
And again, we would submit that Central Hudson provides the government some leeway to take account of the potential speech interests on the other side. The government has not asserted a speech interest here. That is not, I mean, it's the government's burden under Central
Hudson
to identify.
Yeah, I mean, you can make an argument that's not what's involved here, and 2C doesn't solve that problem, because it allows T-shirts that are approved by Trump to be trademarked, but those that aren't approved by Trump not to be. But there's an area of concern here, maybe that's the subject of some other case.
And if the government's interest here in administering this system and Congress's interest in passing the statute were to ensure that political speech couldn't be, you know, trademarked, well, then it has fallen woefully short, because there are all kinds of political slogans, Make America Great Again, Yes We Can, they can get properly trademarked. And then that has the effect of preventing somebody else from using that same speech on their goods. And I just don't think it would be the kind of government interest that could certainly justify the kind of expansive speech regulation that we have here. And the government's only real response, and I should probably take a seat in just a second, is to resist the application of any kind of scrutiny and argue, you know, sort of peddle the same arguments that it made a couple of times.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
Hold on just one second. Could the courtroom deputy maybe turn up the volume a bit, because it's a little hard to hear.
Okay. Thank you.
I think I was just going to make the point that I think it's precisely because this statute is so poorly tailored and can't satisfy even more moderate scrutiny that the government tries to resurrect the same arguments that it made twice to this court and were rejected both times, and that no majority of the Supreme Court has endorsed. And so,
well, I think it didn't need to. This may be the first case in which you know, the very strong viewpoint discrimination basis is missing, and therefore one has to look at more complicated pieces of First Amendment tech.
I think that's right, but I do think that under this court's precedence, in particular Brunetti, there is a minimalist and straightforward way of resolving this case. Applying this court's precedence, the court should simply hold that Section 2C imposes a content-based burden on private speech and must therefore satisfy First Amendment scrutiny, and that it cannot survive even intermediate scrutiny, and that it may not be applied, therefore, to bar registration of the particular proposed mark in this case. And then
Can I ask you, in your reply brief, I think, toward the end, when you clear out a lot of underbrush and you get to what sounds actually like the heart of this, is how strong is this government justification in terms of protecting the right of publicity? And you make an assertion that, I think you do it in quite bold terms, that nowhere would the right of publicity be held to protect this kind of thing. And I think you cite a McCarthy section and three cases, and the McCarthy section is not actually about what the right of publicity does. It's sort of the introductory policy. Here are some things to think about. One of the cases is pure First Amendment, and I think the other two involve, I think, actually Ohio law and quite indirectly Oregon law, as I recall. That doesn't seem like massive support for the proposition that the right of publicity everywhere would recognize that this kind of thing, of course, would be protected.
Well, I don't take the government's argument to be, and my friend can get up and clarify the government's position on this, to be that that President Trump would be able to block distribution of Mr. Elster's T-shirt and that he would lose that case, either as a matter of California law. He lives in California. California has a pretty protective regime for when it comes
to pretty what?
But it has a pretty protective regime for obvious reasons when it comes to publicity rights, given the tremendous percentage
of
celebrities.
Has the California statute been updated since, for example, I recently read Professor Volokh's article, which is now, 18 years old or something, and he notes that the California view of right of publicity is actually rather broader than, for example, the restatement something of unfair competition.
Well, it's the
because it's limited to California industries, let's call them.
Right. Well, I think that the California right of publicity statute, which, you know, on its face could be read to apply here, does then go on to carve out the use of a person's name or likeness in connection with any news, public affairs, or sports broadcast or account or any political campaign.
That's not T-shirts.
Well, even if it wouldn't be read to cover, even if that particular statutory text wouldn't be read to cover T-shirts, then the California Supreme Court itself has held that there would be a First Amendment right here, because what you have here is there's some additional expressive message.
Right. What I wanted to get clear about is that it seems to me one thing you could say, and indeed did say, that as a matter of state law, the state law of right of publicity wouldn't cover this, and that's one thing. Another is to say that, to the extent any state right of publicity covered it, that would be just as unconstitutional as this.
Right. I think that's right. I guess
it would have to be. I mean, your position would have to be that a state law would creating a tort liability for this would be clearly unconstitutional. I mean, it may be that there is a paucity of authority about the right of publicity, but there are cases that are very close to that, Time and Inc. against Hill, and Bartnicki, which isn't cited in the briefs, but is a Supreme Court case, both dealing with the right of privacy and saying, no, you don't have a right of privacy under these circumstances with matters of public concern, even if it's not about a public official.
Right, right. And I think we can all agree, and the government too, that if the government, federal or state, passed a law requiring the consent of any celebrity or politician before their name or likeness could be used in any commercial product, that statute would violate the First Amendment. Otherwise, the only book or T-shirt that you could buy in the marketplace expressing a message about the president would be one that the president himself endorsed, and that's antithetical to the very idea of free speech. And so I think the government, to the extent that it's articulating an interest in just not facilitating the use of a mark that could even possibly violate state law, and so then they're just going to restrict the entire category, I just don't think that's a valid defense for the entire categorical prohibition for three reasons. One is that the government has no legitimate interest in aiding an unconstitutional state law. The second reason is that prophylactic restrictions of this sort, as the Supreme Court held in Zouderer, are not permissible. Otherwise, you could prescribe it all advertising merely because you're concerned that there'll be some false advertising, so you just prohibit the entire category. That's too broad, as the Supreme Court has said. We would submit the same kind of approach would apply here. And I think particularly in this context, as you've noted, Judge Dyke, the pleas for administrative convenience are especially unpersuasive because, the trademark manual is hundreds, maybe even thousands of pages. These are incredibly context-specific judgments that need to be made by PTO examiners. And so I don't think it's too much to ask that these examiners would also then have to take account of the First Amendment interests on the other side.
I'm not sure that delegating the First Amendment authority to the patent examiners is the best way to do it. But unless there are other questions, we'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You
may please
take your
mask
off if you'd like.
I would prefer to keep it on if the panel can hear me. I'll do my best to enunciate.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by emphasizing two points at the beginning.
Isn't this really just another form of viewpoint discrimination in the sense that what it's saying, for example, in the case of Trump, is that messages will be allowed that he approves and messages will be disallowed that he disapproves? It's sort of delegating a form of censorship to the person who's identified. So,
absolutely not, Your Honor. And I don't even take my friend to be arguing that this is viewpoint discriminatory, and with good reason. Because fundamentally, this is an intellectual property protection, and therefore, it is not a question of the viewpoint expressed. As we compile in our brief, there are numerous examples of PTO rejecting pro-Trump marks. This rather tracks the normal rule that if somebody has a copyright, somebody has a trademark, somebody has an intellectual property interest,
The PTO may have rejected pro-Trump marks, but we're talking about under 2C here, and the test seems to be entirely whether the public figure covered by this approves the message or disapproves the message. I mean, it's delegated to that individual to determine whether the mark may be registered or not registered, doesn't it?
Well, that tracks how the right to publicity generally functions, and that's consonant with how other intellectual property rights function. If I have a copyright in some speech, I control whether or not that can be publicly performed or not. That is my right, but it's not because the government is engaging in viewpoint discrimination, but rather because the underlying right belongs to the person who has the intellectual property interest.
You can't seriously contend that a state law making it a tort to criticize a public figure without his or her permission would be consistent with the First Amendment. I mean,
of course not, Your Honor, and that's not what I'm saying. I want to be very clear about what the scope of the right to publicity is, and I particularly refer, Your Honors, to Section 47 of the Restatement on Unfair Competition. And what it says it doesn't cover every mention of a person. Rather, it's restricted to use of somebody's identity or persona in trade. And then it goes on to say that specifically as a canonical example of what an impermissible use would be is incorporating somebody's name or persona into a trademark without authorization. So
okay,
we're not asking...
The restatement also recognizes there's a First Amendment interest here and that the right of publicity is constrained by that. And it just doesn't seem to me that talking about a right of publicity interest makes a lot of sense where you're talking about the ability of someone to criticize a public figure.
Well, two answers to that. One, again, I think it's quite notable that we're not talking about a general prohibition. We're just talking about in the context for use in trade, and particularly in the context here of a federal trademark registration program that leaves Mr. Elster free to put whatever message he wants to on his
t-shirt. Has to do with the fact that it's on a t-shirt rather than being spoken out loud?
No, it's the fact that it's a trademark. As I said, the federal government has no interest in what he puts on his t-shirt. That will ultimately be a question of California law or Florida law or whatever state law may do, and I think there was a colloquy with Judge Toronto about this. But in terms of Section 2C, all you need to consider is whether or not the federal government can withhold the benefits of federal trademark registration from a trademark, something that is supposed to identify the source of goods in trade that misappropriates somebody's identity without their consent.
It seems to be a little late to make that kind of argument after Tam and Brunetti and the Supreme Court indicating that there are First Amendment considerations in the trademark area. And, you know, I don't understand what the government's theory is, since state law couldn't recognize a right of publicity that would create tort liability for this kind of criticism of President Trump.
So there are three things I'd like to say about that. First of all, I think our position here is entirely consonant with Tam and Brunetti, because this is very, very different. Tam and Brunetti involved, as Judge Toronto recognized earlier, provisions that on their face targeted expressive conduct. This court said in both Tam and Brunetti, every time the government applied the immoral and scandalous provision or the disparaging provision, it did so because it recognized that there was expression that the government disapproved of. Here, by contrast, we're targeting a commercial act, the misappropriation of identity. Second, this case is different insofar as the provision is... the second point I wanted to make is we're not trying to refight Tam and Brunetti. We're just saying you shouldn't extend them to a new context. But even if you think we're stuck with Central Hudson, that's fine, because we absolutely think that this readily passes muster under Central Hudson. And the third and related point I'd like to make with regards to Central Hudson is I want to emphasize to the court or commend to the court the Supreme Court's 1993 decision in the Edge Broadcasting case, because what it says is that in the commercial speech context, and this is from page 430 of that decision, you don't look to the specific application. A lot of their argument is it's unconstitutional as applied here. But what Edge Broadcasting tells you is when it's commercial speech, you look at the general governmental interest. You don't look at the specific application and how much the interest is served there. So this is a program designed to facilitate the use of proper source identifiers in commerce. This provision, very much unlike the provisions in Tam and Brunetti, is targeted to the source identifying function. It is not motivated by a desire to control expression, and it is certainly not motivated by a desire to leverage the trademark program in order to affect speech in the world at large.
But it has the effect of allowing President Trump to say, no, you can't have messages on t-shirts that I don't like.
Well, not really, Your Honor.
Really?
So I suppose in practice that can happen in some applications. But as our brief shows, I think, PTO consistently rejects marks that refer to Trump without his consent, and that's going to span the gamut of the range of viewpoints.
But not under 2C, right?
So 2C allows a very limited...
Answer the question. The cases you're talking about are not under 2C.
No, those were 2C rejections, absolutely. In our brief, I'm afraid I don't have the page site handy.
2C rejections in which Trump had approved the trademark?
One more time, Your Honor, I'm sorry?
2C rejections in which Trump has approved the trademark?
Oh, no, not when Trump has approved the trademark, but when the applicant, the mark sought to be registered, is pro-Trump. Trump is the God.
Sure,
God has a plan,
all,
and Trump
is
the man.
It's all up to Trump. It's all up to Trump. You can do it if I like the mark. You can't do it if I don't like the mark.
Well, I in practice, I think everybody who tries, except Trump himself and the narrow universe of people who may be able to get his authorization, are going to be rejected regardless of the viewpoint of the mark. The governmental interest here is not about protecting Trump. It's not about controlling speech.
It's not about protecting Trump. What, I mean, that's exactly what it's done. It supposedly you're protecting his right to publicity.
Well, I should have phrased that a little differently. It's about respecting Trump's intellectual property interest in his persona for use in trade. What it is not about is shielding Trump from criticism. And I think that is what makes this fundamentally different than
not about the content of the message, which might have some significant correlation with what the named person might consent to or not, but you're saying that's just not the interest.
I'm saying that's not the asserted governmental interest, unlike in Tam and Brunetti when the government was targeting expression.
As a procedural matter, when one of these person naming marks is applied for, is there a process of giving notice to said person?
Not as far as I'm aware. I think the burden is on the applicant. So if you put in an application that refers to Trump, and I think if you go through the joint appendix
there's
a correspondence.
No consent presented, it's just assumed there is.
Right, so a notice goes out. It's a rejection notice that says, we find that this refers to Trump. There's nothing on file saying that you have produced Trump's written consent to this. And then the burden is on the applicant, again, regardless of the viewpoint, to challenge that denial by coming forward with the written consent.
Your other rationale beyond right of publicity and privacy is protecting against consumer confusion for 2C, but isn't that the precise rationale for 2A, which is a more narrowly tailored restriction to ban false suggestions of a connection with a person?
So I certainly 2A is the primary means for dealing with that. The Patent and Trademark Office has recognized that 2C buttresses that interest and supplements it, and I think that's permissible to have mutually
reinforcing. But I'm just trying to understand, 2C must be about something beyond consumer confusion, given that we have 2A on the books that's precisely tailored to consumer confusion.
Well, I think it's okay, particularly in the context of something like a trademark registration program, to have mutually reinforcing provisions. So I'd refer to the court to the Supreme Court's decision in the so-called Gay Olympics case, San Francisco Arts and Athletics versus the U.S. Olympic Committee. And there, what the Supreme Court recognized was the government had an interest. Although 2A was also in place, the Supreme Court said the government's interest in giving protection to the word Olympics and and preventing possible consumer confusion there or association may allow for an even broader exemption that was applied there to the word Olympics than would be captured by 2A. And that was something the Supreme Court thought was acceptable, particularly in light of the commercial context to which the Lanham Act applies. So I do think that it is okay and permissible for Congress to say that certain kinds of conduct are particularly susceptible to consumer confusion and to misuse, and to draft a broader supplementary rule that applies in that context.
Part of the problem that I'm having is that sort of conceptually that seems true, but it seems like the exceptional case of what 2C would apply to rather than the ordinary case. The Tom Brady example seems, an unusual one, whereas the examples of negative commentary marks seems like the heartland of 2C, of what nobody would dream of attributing to the named person, in which case,
So I would just take issue as an empirical matter with that intuition. I think this case is the exceptional case where somebody's trying to trademark what is essentially a political slogan. The heartland of 2C, and indeed all of the Lanham Act, is not about addressing political speech or expression. It's about source identifiers for goods in commerce. So I think the most common application you're going to see is something much more like Obama Pajama, which was a case from about 10 years ago, something where there's not any clear statement of political valence one way or the other, but rather just an attempt to capitalize on somebody's celebrity and to use that to, without authorization, in order to try to sell goods in commerce and to attract attention. And that's the heartland of what the right of publicity is addressing.
Wouldn't 2A be the basis for that as well?
I can tell you that Obama pajama was a 2C rejection, and one of the advantages of 2C is that it requires
no real factual inquiry for the examiner.
Exactly.
Right.
It's administrable.
Incredibly simple.
Yes. And I think that's a virtue, and I think particularly in the commercial sphere, under Central Hudson, you don't need a perfect fit.
But
you need a legitimate interest.
Where's the government interest? Since you agree that, as I understand it, that the right of publicity or the right of privacy doesn't apply as a matter of tort law under these circumstances, that you could not give a president a tort law right to sue somebody for violation of his right of publicity when there is political criticism. So where is the government interest? Just forget about the breadth of the statute and the fact that it may have some constitutional applications. How can it be that the government has an interest here which couldn't be recognized in tort law?
So I would take issue. I'm not conceding that what Mr. Elster is trying to do could not be the basis for tort liability. And I want to be pellucid on this point. There is a fundamental difference between putting a message on a T-shirt and or trying to say that message and engage in political speech and incorporating somebody's identity into a trademark.
Okay, what case law, as in tort law, has ever sustained liability under circumstances like this? I'm not aware of any case. Can you cite any case?
I'm not aware of a countervailing example, but Section 47 of the restatement says categorically, a canonical example of how of an infringement of the right to publicity is incorporating somebody's name into a trademark without their consent. And so I do think that this is fundamentally different.
Restatement also says it's got to be cabined by First Amendment interests.
And I think that starts to be implicated when you're operating outside of the use in trade, where a lot of the action is here is figuring out when something crosses over from use in trade to creation or expression. And there are doubtless complicated and difficult questions at the margins of that. But one place where it is very clear and administrable and free of those questions is when you're talking about a program that only applies to use in trademarks. I'd also like to return back to the Edge Broadcasting case I mentioned earlier. I took, and perhaps I misunderstood my friend, but I understood him to say that, yes, this statute does have constitutional applications. He went through three different situations where 2C might apply. And he seemed to recognize there was a legitimate governmental interest supporting many of those applications. And he said, but it's just not as constitutional as applied here, or the government's interest isn't particularly strong as applied here. I take issue with that. But even if you accept what he's saying, under Edge Broadcasting and Central Hudson, which does not require perfect tailoring, that's enough to sustain Section 2C.
Can you just remind me, what was Edge Broadcasting specifically about?
Edge Broadcasting was a case about radio licenses, and there was a broadcaster. It was at the North Carolina-Virginia border. There were one state allowed lotteries, the other did not, and there was an advertisement about a broadcaster who was in the non-lottery state, North Carolina, but whose service area included Virginia, wanted to run lottery ads that would reach into Virginia because they wanted the revenue from that. And there was a categorical rule that said if you're in a non-lottery state, you can't have air ads from promoting the lottery. And there was an argument made there that, as applied to the factual circumstances of that case, that the government interest wasn't particularly forwarded by, or furthered, I should say, by applying that prohibition there. And the Supreme Court said that's the wrong question to ask. Instead, you don't look at the extent to which the interest is furthered as applied to that particular plaintiff. Rather, you look at the general course of conduct the government is regulating. In the commercial sphere context, you do not think about this on an as-applied basis. And I think given especially in light of what I took to be Mr. Elster's recognition that there are legitimate interests here, And I think there he has to recognize that.
The problem with that argument, seems to me, is that it looks as though the 2C's a very significant part of the 2C application would be unconstitutional, and that you're saying it can be preserved because it has some minor protection in the Brady example or some other example like that.
Well, I think, again, some of this is an empirical question that goes to, I think the fact that this case involves a political slogan risks creating the intuition that the heartland of 2C is about political speech, and that's simply incorrect. That's not what this provision is mostly about. It is not what it targets. It is about something which most states similarly recognize as a basic commercial right, the right not to have your identity appropriated. And if at bottom,
But not in circumstances like this. I mean, you're not able to cite a single case which has imposed tort liability in a situation where it's a speech on a controversial issue, and the individual who is being criticized is suing for interference with his right of publicity.
I haven't seen a countervailing case either. And again, this is not about the speech. This is about the trademark. And those two are, in fact, the heartland baked into the very premise of Tam and Brunetti is that there's a difference between the speech and the source identifier. Tam and Brunetti were about the speech. The government was targeting expression. This is not that case. The government is targeting the commercial conduct of selecting a source identifier that misappropriates someone else's identity. And I don't think the court should lightly disregard that interest, which is widely recognized. It's reflected in the statutes of at least 33 states or the common law of 33 states. And though Mr. Elster's kind of dismissive of the right to publicity on page 41 of his brief, he comes awfully close to saying the court should just not treat that as a legitimate interest. I don't think the court should rush to disregard such a widely recognized form of intellectual property and to suggest that Congress has no legitimate interest in a trademark protection statute of all places in showing regard for intellectual property rights.
Would you agree that 2C is a content-based regulation in the sense that it's treating differently trademark speech that identifies an individual, treating those kinds of trademark speech different than other trademark speech?
In some sense, it's certainly content-based. If you look to the Supreme Court's decision in Reed, the way that defined content-based, to decide the applicability, you need to look to the subject of the content of the speech to figure out whether the restriction applies. Of course, it's content-based. But that's going to be true about any number of provisions in the Lanham Act, and I think the court should be very careful before it adopts and extends what it said in Tam and Brunetti and applies that not just to a restriction or a prohibition that's related to targeting expression and leveraging the trademark program in an effort to affect speech outside the program, and instead applies it to a core provision designed to regulate what types of source identifiers are appropriate.
Okay, but then what would be the reason why it's not a content-based regulation?
I'm not saying it's not content-based in some sense. What I'm saying is it's not content-based in the sense that Reed, for example, would be talking about, and certainly not it's distinguishable from Tam and Brunetti. So again, in other First Amendment contexts, for example, like a limited public forum, and I don't need to have the fight right now about whether or not the limited public forum analogy applies here, though I'm very happy to answer questions about that. But in a limited public forum, the government can engage in content discrimination. So the fact that this is affects content is not fatal on its face, or doesn't even necessarily mean strict scrutiny or anything like it has to apply. In a limited public forum, content discrimination is fine as long as it's reasonably related to the purposes of the forum. And I would say, for example, the Lanham Act is about protecting intellectual property rights and furthering the use of source identifiers in commerce, certainly showing regard for an intellectual property right like the right to publicity and the right to privacy is consonant with the purposes of the forum and therefore would be upheld.
Before you sit down, could you address the question that Judge Toronto and I were asking your friend on the other side, and that is, how does the Patent and Trademark Office address the problem of trademarking political slogans that are in general currency and would permit somebody to get the rights to a trademark on a t-shirt and to prevent other people from putting that same slogan on another t-shirt.
So I don't think the Patent and Trademark Office has much of a solution here, but I thought that colloquy really exposed the fact that First Amendment interests are implicated in both directions in this case, and the fact that there's a certain irony that Mr. Elster is in here asking, invoking the First Amendment in an effort to get exclusive rights such that he could prevent others from engaging in the same speech that he wants to engage in.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Taylor. We'll give you 2 minutes here.
Try to be brief here, just a few quick points in rebuttal. First, we're not arguing that this statute is viewpoint-based, but the statute is plainly content-based. The government has agreed, and it's not content-based in some trivial way.
Why isn't it viewpoint-based in the sense that it's the viewpoints approved by the public figure that get trademarked, and those that he or she disapproves don't?
I think that's right. This is a particularly pernicious form of content-based regulation because not only does it make...
Why isn't that viewpoint-based? It depends on the viewpoint of the public individual as to whether it...
I think there might be an argument that it is, but we think this law is so indefensible, even under Central Hudson, that we're not pressing that argument here. But you're right to note that it hands public figures a monopoly about speech that is used about them in registered trademarks. And so I think that... You know, if the government, as it says, is not contesting or refighting the this court's cases in Tam and Brunetti, then you have to apply at least Central Hudson. So on Central Hudson, two quick points. The government acts like it wants this court to ignore the nature of the mark in this case and calls it an exceptional case, a marginal case, not the garden variety mark. But even if you look at the general program as a whole, the statute here sweeps way too far, and this case shows that. It's an example. It is the government's burden. It has an evidentiary burden under Central Hudson to show that the mark here doesn't trench on protected speech. I'm just going to quickly read a couple of quotes from Central Hudson because I think the Central Hudson itself forecloses the government's argument here. The restriction must directly advance the state interest involved. The regulation may not be sustained if it provides only ineffective or remote support for the government's purpose. And if the government interest could be served by a more limited restriction on commercial speech, the excessive restrictions cannot survive. The state cannot regulate speech that poses no danger to the asserted state interest, nor can it completely suppress information when narrower restrictions on expression would serve its interest as well.
Do you have an idea for what a narrower form of 2C might look like?
Well, it might look like 2A to start. I think that gets you about 90% of where the government might want to go.
What might be some words that would start to capture the remaining 10%?
Well, I think the Tom Brady example, Obama's pajamas, I think is sort of a marginal case.
But
I think
there's how would you write it, I think, is the question.
Well, it's not, it's respectfully, it's Congress's burden to come up with a statute.
But I'm trying to get to grab a hold or get a better hold on what the concept is that might be capturable.
Right. So I think the underlying concept is if a celebrity or politician's name or likeness is being used toward no kind of First Amendment end, no expressive end, just merely for the purpose of capturing the consuming public's attention and getting them to buy the product, and it's totally orthogonal to any kind of message, I think the First Amendment right that the mark holder has in using that person's name is pretty minimal, and there might be an opportunity for Congress to just target that more narrow circumstance.
What Supreme Court case in the commercial and the product advertising context distinguishes between coarse First Amendment speech and mere commercial speech?
Well, I think the origin of the Supreme Court's modern commercial speech cases is Virginia Board of Pharmacists, and then Central Hudson establishes the four-part test. But I think that, as those cases show and other cases, it can be difficult to determine the difference between purely commercial speech and some kind of expressive speech. And I think you know, this court tried to, in its decision in Brunetti, come up with a bifurcated framework where you apply strict scrutiny if it's regulating only the expressive components of a mark, but intermediate scrutiny if it's regulating only the commercial components of a mark. I think in a given case, that can be difficult to discern the difference between the two. And I think if a mark has a kind of political message or expressive component that goes beyond the merely commercial, I think that the argument, we would submit that there's a pretty good case to be made for applying the stricter form of scrutiny there. But we're not asking this court to go that far. I think that all this court needs to do is apply Central Hudson because it's a pretty straightforward case.
Why is this a content-based regulation?
It's a content-based regulation because, as this court recognized in Brunetti, it makes it so it's regulating the content of a mark, the speech that can be used in a mark, based entirely on the words that are used, and that makes it content.
I mean, it's saying if the famous person, let's say, is identified or not identified, that's the only thing that makes it content-based, right?
Well, that's right. So the PTO has registered the mark, no disease is too small. But Trump too small, can't be registered. So the difference between those two is speech, right? It's the content of the speech. And the government has decided to draw a line between the two based on the speech that is used to communicate the mark. And that makes it content-based. And it's not just the
Supreme
Court.
Do you think just about every provision in 1052 is content-based? All the restrictions?
I think that's the nature of trademark law. And I think that's one reason why Central Hudson at least allows for a slightly more flexible framework. Now, I will say the important thing about Central Hudson scrutiny is that there is the first component, which is you've got to show that it's truthful or that it's not deceptive speech in some commercial sense or misleading speech. So if you're giving, if you have a mark that creates confusion as to the source of the mark, or is false, falsely suggesting an endorsement, or just does something else that will work some real economic harm to consumers, that can properly be restricted under Central Hudson. That distinguishes it from political speech, which can be false, true, or what have you.
So suppose the statute said simply, you can't have a mark which bears the name, signature, or likeness of a famous person. Would that be okay?
Without the opportunity for consent. I think that I can't imagine that Congress would want to enact that statute because if you wanted to create a business with your own name.
Be okay?
What's that?
Would that be okay?
I think it's still content-based and they'd have to justify it. I don't know what the justification would be there. It's the government's burden. If it couldn't come up with a justification, then I don't think it would be okay. It would eliminate this problem that you've identified, Judge Dyke, about creating a kind of monopoly in the use of someone's famous person's name.
Can I just get clarity about, are we talking about one that doesn't have a consent qualifier?
That's the way that I understood the hypothetical.
Mr. Trump couldn't
his own name.
Trademark his own name.
Right, and that's why I don't think that Congress would enact a statute like that, because I think Trump properly has an interest in the commercial value of his name. It's the name of his company, and I think that he can trademark that. We're not saying that he can't. But what he doesn't have is some kind of absolute right to prohibit commercial speech about him just because it uses his name. I think that's antithetical to the First Amendment. And the last point I would make, just and this dovetails with it, is that the government places heavy emphasis on the fact that we're using his name or likeness, or my client is rather, in trade, as if that's like the thing that matters. But that's an extraordinary argument because it would apply equally to copyright, and it would mean that Trump would have a right to prohibit unauthorized biographies about him or newspaper accounts that use his name or T-shirts that express messages. And the government today embraces the consequences of this. It actually takes the position that my client could be subject to liability for selling T-shirts and using as his source identifier a message that is critical of the former president of the United States and could even be subject, I take it, to criminal prosecution. And if that is what the question of this case amounts to, question in this case amounts to, it's an even easier case than I thought because that is utterly at war with the First Amendment.
Okay, I think we're out of time.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank both counsel. That was well argued. And the case is submitted.